David Birdsell, of course, the Marks Dean of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs, talking about the great Baruch College. And we welcome in the fantastic David Birdsell. Sir, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I am managing, as we all are, as best as we could. But I tell you, I was happy to wake up, and if I didn't find it on the alert, you know, as far as the Senate going along with this rescue package, my head would have spun off this morning coming on these airwaves. Listen, $2.2 trillion. Let's get it going. We still gotta get it to the House tomorrow, there, David Birdsell, and who knows, you know? But I'm confident that the sign-offs will be in play, and the president will sign off immediately on that once that happens. But contentious times over the last couple of days, sir.
Absolutely. We saw discussions about basic philosophy, what needs to be done, what's the scale of the bill. Remember when this conversation started, it began as a $1 trillion effort, of course, more than doubled over the course of conversations about what needed to be done and growing awareness about the breadth of the impact on healthcare facilities, on the economy overall, and on individual Americans. So I expect, you know, Speaker Pelosi has certainly said that she expects that there will be passage in the House and then a rapid signature from the president. And we shouldn't look to this to be the only rescue bill. This is the first of what I suspect will be several to come, focusing on neglected businesses and persons and facilities. You can't get everything into a single package when the impact is as broad as coronavirus has been for this country and will continue to be for at least months to come.
No question. David, the key components, obviously, getting money to people in their bank accounts in 3 weeks. Small businesses, you know, the unemployment. I know there was a bit of a snag, correct? You had about four Republican senators that kind of thought, you know what, it's almost better to be unemployed than to be at work. And they had to really have a lot of strong dialogue last night, correct?
Well, that's right. And their concern was about the addition of $600 in weekly benefits, which I understand at one level, but at another level, this impact is going to be so big. We have predictions from major financial institutions when the unemployment numbers are released today, the lowest of which is for 1.5 million new jobless claims, which will make it by a factor of nearly double the highest number of jobless claims that we've ever seen. People need this support. They're going to need more than is provided in this bill. But again, I don't see that this is the last of the bills to come, just the first of what will be a series of an effort to rescue individuals and institutions in this country.
A lot of objections, you know, even a couple of days ago, some of the provisions in this thing, you know, as far as the Kennedy Center, I think that's still in there. You know, $35 million originally, I think it's down to $25 million. Wind, solar turbines, greenhouse gas, retirement, community newspapers, you know, some of the banks and unions. I mean, please, this is do people know, the Bernie Sanders of the world know that this is a rescue package? My goodness. 175 million Americans right now affected in quarantine situations, and we're bandying about putting a Kennedy Center renovation in play here. I got to tell you, I can't take it.
They're in any case, when you have a big bill like this, it was true of the troubled asset relief plan. It was true of the stimulus plan under Barack Obama. People see opportunities to feather their own nests, and that is what happens. There's less of that in this bill than there has been in some previous bills, and one of the first sticking points of the negotiation was to create greater oversight over where the money would be spent. The original program gave the president essentially free hand and no disclosure requirements for about $500 billion worth of the spending. There are now oversight panels to make sure that the at least the more flagrant abuses do not take place. And, of course, much of this money is going directly to Americans in the form of $1,200 checks with a $500 increment per child for people making under $75,000. It then begins to be reduced between $75,000 and $99,000 in yearly income, and nothing for people who earn more than $99,000, which is appropriate because they don't need it. But the This bill is, by the standards of these bills, cleaner than most.
No question. David Birdsall with us, Brooke. And, you know, and you're right. Allocation was huge here, right, David? I mean, you got to make sure that, listen, I can understand trepidation, you know, as far as all the money being bandied about, large corporations, stock buybacks. And I listen, I get it. But I think allocation was the key here. And you had to, listen, first and foremost, you got to put it in the American worker. These businesses are going under left and right. People are unemployed, furloughed, whatever it is. You must put money in people's wallets at this point in time. But I understand the fear somewhat as far as where that money goes. That was the sticking point in the beginning of negotiation.
Oh, you're absolutely right. If we take that untethered $500 billion in the original version of the bill, that money was able to be spent on corporate bailouts with no corresponding requirement that those corporations keep people employed, and that's been changed. And that's, of course, the appropriate thing to do here. If you're going to provide a business with public resources to stay in business during a time when often government policy, for very good reasons, has put you out of the restaurants, entertainment venues, sports teams, a whole host of employers, then the quid pro quo has to be that you keep your people employed as a condition of access to these resources. And that's largely been accomplished in the bill that is now before the House. So that was worth a strong argument and an argument that came out the right way, in my view, when it emerged from negotiations over the weekend.
The president, one of his briefings the other day, you know, April, Easter Sunday, let's kind of pinpoint that on the calendar, getting everybody back to work. You know, a lot of people were on that, you know, certainly very flexible based on where we're at right now. You can't even consider New York City as far as anything of that nature right now. It's the epicenter, let's face it, here in this country. But what about that aspect? What was your assessment when he gave that Easter date 17 days from now as far as starting up the engines again? What were you thinking overall?
Well, I have only one word, I'm afraid, and that is reckless. We cannot be in the business, it seems to me, and the president cannot be in the business of setting arbitrary deadlines and deciding that the world will change when we see that right now this virus is spreading like wildfire through different areas of the country, notably New York City. Of course, we are the epicenter for the United States. We have 7% of the world's cases right here in the five boroughs as I look out over 6th Avenue in Manhattan from my apartment. And that demands a certain kind of response, but it's not, of course, just New York. We see dramatic spread in Louisiana, which is now, although starting with smaller numbers, growing at a faster rate than New York. You did not have in New Orleans the kind of lockdown strategy that has been employed here in California and in many cities throughout the United States. And as a result, you have surging rates of coronavirus. To simply say that in 2 weeks' time we're going to be in a position to begin to roll back these measures is not taking account of what's happening on the ground. And it should only be made by accounting for what's happening on the ground. It may be possible sooner rather than later, although this is not the opinion of any epidemiologist that I'm aware of, to go to a more calibrated strategy, tracking cell phone data, for example, doing a massive increase in tests so that you can track infected individuals and figure out exactly with whom they've been in contact. But that assumes a lot of change that right now we aren't prepared to do. And because we do not have a national program to produce ventilators, to produce hospital equipment, or to produce tests at the volume that we would need to make such a strategy effective, setting an Easter date is simply not reasonable in my view, and I'm afraid it qualifies under the reckless term that I used a moment ago.
Birdsall, a couple of minutes remain. David, you know, at this point in time, why not move the presidential primary for all it's worth? Just move it to June 23rd. You know, you have primary day then for many a race here in the state, Long Island. Why not just automatically come out today and say, you know what, April 28th to June 23rd, hands down. Just definitively say that, no?
Well, to definitively say something, it does right now strain the imagination to think that we're going to be in a position to gather hundreds of thousands of people in public places across New York State to vote. We know that voting lines are long and difficult at the best of times. Can you imagine what this is going to look like if we have to maintain 6 feet of distance in the polling place and waiting in line to get into the polling place? The likely impact on participation rates, already perilously bad in New York State. We have poor rates of voting among registered voters and party registered voters in the state for primary elections. You can imagine that would go through the floor. And so, yes, I think the idea of providing more time in this case, if it's done in a structured way and advertised in ways that people are all aware and you have some chance of boosting participation rates. We didn't end elections. Of course, we had no primary elections at that time, but Abraham Lincoln kept the elections on schedule during the Civil War, which was a very different challenge, but a very serious challenge, obviously. It's important to preserve democracy in a predictable way and in a safe way, and I think that these are goals that can be met. A delay would be one way to get that done.
Last one, as far as these ventilators are concerned, now, I'm getting mixed messages now, and I'm not happy about it. Because, I know the governor has pointed out that cities are subordinate to states, and his say-so overrides the word of local mayors. I get that. But it seems to me he's suggesting that same dynamic works on the federal level and that the national government can overrule the states. I don't know if that's true. I don't even think that's true. Because when I look at it overall, David, tell me if I'm wrong, but constitutionally I'm talking about here. States, unlike cities, they are, as I call them, sovereign entities. And for the president to order, let's say, bars and gyms to close, to me, that's an unprecedented use of executive authority. That would make him almost like a dictator. Am I right in that assessment overall? And I'm talking about how states in general can do their own thing here.
Well, the president has invoked a statute that gives him the powers that he would have in wartime. And that may be enough to order the kinds of closures that some people contemplate, although evidently per the conversation about Easter just a moment ago, the president is not contemplating using. And with regard to distribution of material in the government's, in the federal government's possession, the national stockpile of 14,000 ventilators, for example, by the way, not enough to meet the estimated need just in New York City if we walk this 5 weeks out. But nonetheless, the federal government has absolute control over those distribution standards. You know, we're going to be in a very interesting place. We already are. The governor has been very clear that the $3.1 billion coming to New York State is less than a quarter of what we need to make the budget whole here. We have the largest number of cases in New York. We're going to take the largest hit in terms of the percentage impact on the economy, at least in these early days of the virus's spread. And the federal government needs to think about taking account of that. And they have a lot of tools at their disposal. Right now, it does not seem that the president is willing to employ the powers that he has invoked under wartime provisioning statutes to force the creation of gowns, of masks, of other personal protective equipment, and, of course, of ventilators, which are so desperately necessary right here, right now.
No question. David, before we let you go, as you look out your Manhattan window onto 6th Avenue, what are you seeing for us?
I see two people, both walking dogs, just a trickle of automobiles. The city is really remarkably empty. People are observing the shelter in place or they've gone somewhere else, which we've seen has caused some trouble in communities from Long Island to New England to Florida. But I took a long walk for exercise, permitted under the New York on Pause Act, last night, and passed maybe three people on a walk of 2.5 miles. So this city is a very, very different place from what it was even a week ago.
Believable. Well, listen, you stay safe, okay, my friend? We'll talk to you soon.
You as well, and everybody listening. Be well.
There you go, the great David Birdsall. How about that? A bird cell view, I say, of Manhattan as we speak. Desolate.